This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I should probably begin by begging for mercy from our literary colleagues who will, at one or two points, find me rediscovering the wheel. It's the reading by an amateur, I hope, in a respectable sense. William Anastasi most recently showed hundreds of photocopies of his manuscript Jerry Joyce Notes last February and March here at the Slot Foundation in an exhibition curated by Osvaldo Romberg under the Joycean title Me Alters Egos. These consisting of Du Jarry sheets from 1991 to 94 and Me Inner Man monophone sheets of 1991 to 96. The display was reinstalled in the late spring in a Joyce in Art exhibition at the Royal Hibernian Academy in Dublin in observance through the summer of the 100th anniversary of the Joycean Bloomsday. Anastasi also generated curious offshoots of some of these in the form of twice Xeroxed monotypes. And as it was still available, like this one here, this is the one I'm speaking of, and as it was still available, I decided to buy the one derived from sheet number 701, signed and dated last February 15th, during the Philadelphia show, which Aaron also liked for the publicity for this conference. Intrigued by the image's defetishized, dubiously autographic status, I wanted to catch glimpses of it off guard and think about it, especially for the prominent textual illumination in the medieval manuscript sense, uncommon though not unique among Anastasi's original 1800 or so sheets. It seemed to hold intriguing reverberations that I can now attempt to illuminate. First, let us affirm in passing that Anastasi's comprehensive installational format, neither scroll nor codex, with manuscript sheets papering the walls, partook of a canonical format of conceptual art of the mid-1970s, as well as looking one at a time like Duchampian notes. One thinks most readily of Hannah Darboven's covering entire gallery interiors with handwritten run-on numerical tabulations inscribed on separately framed sheets, rank upon rank, as well as her published holographic writings out in artist's book editions of extended texts by the likes of Heine, Baudelaire, and Karl Krauss. For Anastasi's part, we know that for over a decade, he has concerned himself with excavating more or less obscure yet amazingly proliferous connections between Alfred Jarry, the proto-Dadaist of the 1890s and aughts, and both Joyce on the one hand and Marcel Duchamp on the other. Here I can take advantage of my status as a guest arbiter in the literary realm to make certain Anastasian observations, possibly somewhat crosswise, between Jarry Duchamp and Jarry Joyce, that I can only hope are not considered erroneous or worse, commonplace. My only encouragement to risk writing out of blessed ignorance is that so much of what Anastasi has been tracking in his thousands of notes concerns Finnegan's Wake, that in thorough ignorance of specifically that most formidable work, I am moved by creative desperation to take advantage of whatever first-hand connaissance I retain from Joyce's earlier texts. The Duchampian motif which this form most closely resembles is an element projected for but not eventually incorporated into the large glass, namely a sex cylinder, a.k.a. wasp, for the bride. Resemblance here concerns not only the respective conical forms, but also their illuminational embeddedness in their respective holographical contexts of writing. I show Duchamp's two-leaved format as originally reproduced by Lebel in 1959. Schwartz's catalogue raisonné now shows only the right-hand leaf of this to illustrate the drawing which is in the Pompidou Center. Duchamp's drawing is one of three showing the funneling conical form of the wasp, all done at Herne Bay in Kent, in England, in July of 1913. It seems that during the summer after the Armory show, Duchamp, himself planning to make his living as a librarian, had gone with his sister Yvonne to this seaside town, not far from the Dover ferry, while she studied English there. And wouldn't it have been Weismann-esque of Duchamp to get that far but never bother to go to London? Schwartz's 1997 catalog, The Complete Works, offers three wasp or sex cylinder studies, manuscript, this and two others, manuscript notes with sketches, two of which he identifies as projects, this is a quotation, for an unrealized detail of the bride's domain in the large glass, and the third, this, as an unrealized project for the bride's domain of the large glass and also reproduced in facsimile in the green box, 1934. This last design was not only illustrated in Lebel's foundational monograph, this 1959 Sieur Marcel Duchamp, it also appears in the decorative endpaper graphics of the original edition, of which, by the way, Bill Anastasi has shown me a copy inscribed by Duchamp. And there, the graphic layout itself is cataloged by Schwartz involving Duchamp's personal intervention as just another work in the oeuvre of Marcel Duchamp, the design of these endpapers for the 1959 Lebel. This, not dated by Schwartz, but placed between November 1958 and May 1959, while reiterating already facsimile notes and sketches borrowed from the green box. So it's sort of the third layer, the end papers of the book. Just in case this seems too simple, Anastasi reports that in his copy of the first edition, the cone points downward, not up, as shown here in the end papers as illustrated by Schwartz. The only significant discrepancy I find between Anastasi's illumination of his written-out text and the Duchampian prototype concerns the loopy little curved feature atop the cone. What Anastasi shows, I think I have a close-up of it, actually. Let's see. Yeah, good. And describes in writing as a, quote, phallic protrusion that is, quote, limp in comparison with a comparable form in a drawing by Jarry, is actually a bit of a misprision based on reading the swelling inside shadow of a little semi-hemispheric domical form as something like a fat worm or a little snail, and only consequentially phallic, perhaps by induction from the necktie or cravat of the chocolate grinder drawn in the same year. Otherwise, his cone, like the wasp prototype, is penetrated by a right-angled tube up through its narrow base and then topped by a thick curved spout spilling back into its wide top like a filter or percolator coffee pot. Speaking of which, while taking the textual source as Jarry-esque and the image as basically Duchampian, I want also to suggest on the visual side a painting by Man Ray, The Filter, Percolator, of 1917, itself related to Duchamp's two chocolate grinder paintings of 1913-14, those dry runs for the large glass. The filter percolator, by the way, was first exhibited in 1921 here in Philadelphia, as a matter at the Pennsylvania Academy, and then in Paris. And in light of Anastasi, other works by Man Ray also seem to take on, for me, retroactive influence, as I like to put it. In one of the most famous, Lampshade, 1919, reproduced, which is not the same as reproduced, by Arturo Schwartz, the redoer of Marcel Duchamp's ready-mades in 1959, a single unfurled conical spiral, non-formal in its geometric inevitability, reminds me of the carefully stacked fanning-out steel rods on which Anastasi worked in 1968 and showed at the Dwan Gallery 2 years later. Otherwise, perhaps nothing by any other artist now seems as retroactively Anastasian to me as Man Ray's Obstruction of 1920, reproduced by Schwartz in 1964, I should explain that what I mean by retroactive influence is something that I've written very loosely about, is that it's in the reflected light of Bill Anastasi's paintings and drawings and objects that I go back to Man Ray saying, where was that thing that I was once thinking about? Now, the absurdist iconography of the wasp is curiously non-absurdly akin to the sometimes supposed first Duchamp ready-made. The practically forgotten rotating chimney cowl or ventilator bought in 1915 in a New York hardware store and given to, only to be lost by, Louise Varez, née Norton, and her husband Edgard. The piece was titled Pulled at Four Pins, or in French, Tiré à Quatre Épingles, a French figure of speech that finds its equivalent in Dressed to the Nines, though then what should not be overlooked is the possible extra tinge in English of being at sixes and sevens, that is, at loose ends or frazzled. Although not only André Breton and Gabriel Bouffé-Picabia later referred to this object as a weather vane, but Duchamp himself, in a letter of 1964, as Edgard Varèse managed at the time to recall, quote, this ready-made was in gray, unpainted tin, and it was not a weather vane. This is Varèse remembering. It was not a weather vane, but one of those round ventilators which are put on chimneys to make them draw better. We also know what the lost ready-made looked like because in 1964, despite his calling it a weather vane, Duchamp produced an almost sentimentally lyrical reminiscence of it, the oddly lovely etching Pulled at Four Pins of 1964 that we have been looking at, based on the ready-made and inscribed in French to indicate that the upper part turns while the lower part is fixed, so as both parts are seen to share a single axle, axe in French, to which the stable cone is fixed, the flighty dunce cap of a top would whirl free in response to the wind. May we add in passing what might here be a pataphysical promise in establishing, might have pataphysical promise in establishing the fact that the most prominent formal feature of Pulled at Four Pins, the curved silhouette of its topping Beretta-like fin as ending in a knob-like terminal form, that though trouvé, this form did manage uncannily to recapitulate in Raymond Duchamp-Villon's only famous sculpture, The Snout of the Bronze Cubist Horse of 1914, that it did not influence the funnel-like form suggestive of Joyce that Duchamp conjured up to only to leave out of the large glass and which, I dare not say, but Anastasi has reassigned to Jarry. After all, in the context of the large glass, the purpose, if we can use such a word, of the wasp was by virtue of passing air currents to get the vaporous love gasoline moving upward from a lower to a higher temperature, may we. In his catalog, Schwartz gives the text accompanying Duchamp's drawing as ventilation, crossing out, start from an interior draft. But it may be better to observe the layout of the key statement so that the statement looks vaguely like an equation with ventilation on top of inside at the far left and draft over nothing at all on the right. Anyway, the free orientation of Duchamp's endpaper design may be enough to license our thinking of it as akin to Pulled at Four Pins. The text that the drawing at hand illuminates, like a drawn or painted figure sharing space with a text on a medieval manuscript leaf, begins with words of William Anastasi about Alfred Jarry and ends with Jarry's own words, all, of course, in Jarry's hand. In fact, as it is Anastasi's custom with these sheets to color code the authorial words of Jarry, Joyce, and Duchamp with black for his own, one can see here, as in a red letter New Testament, exactly which words were first written by Jarry himself. The inscription begins in mid-sentence with Anastasi mentioning one of those children's games of skill with which a ball is to be tossed up from and then caught back upon a stick. Quote, and bears great resemblance to the ball and chain drawings given, crossing out, by Jarry's translator, which must have been a common toy during Jarry's life and Duchamp's childhood. Then comes the cone drawing, followed thusly, quote, "Note that in Duchamp's drawing, consistent with my observation vis-a-vis the hapless bachelors, the phallic protrusion is limp compared to the erected version on the drawing of the toy. If the toy was designed like, crossing out, Duchamp's drawing, you wouldn't be able to play. And as so often in life, so also it is with the bachelors as Duchamp has designed them, crossing out. Jerry's story ends on a different note from Duchamp's. His Sisyphus is made of sterner stuff than the stuff of Duchamp's bachelors," end quote. Beyond this point, the handwriting is Anastasie's, but the writing is Jarry's. "And the Eternal opened his mouth, and so did Mr. Sisyphus. And the Eternal listened, and," crossing out, "Mr. Sisyphus spoke thus, 'Dear Master.'" What Anastasie is talking about here becomes clear when the quoted text is traced to Jarry's Days and Nights, Novel of a Deserter, 1897, specifically a translation by Alexis Liquiard that includes a pair of explanatory cup and ball drawings, in one of which the ball, whether completely free or on a cord or metaphoric chain like ball and chain, comes to rest in a hollow at the end of the handle, presumably easier to score, but also easier to lose, and the other in which the ball sockets onto a phallic prong, harder to score, but then very much more put away. In February of 2000, after Anastasie's drawings were done, but before they were exhibited in Philadelphia and Dublin, Francis Naumann suggested not only that just such a toy was really the very first Duchampian ready-made, but that it was inspired by Jarry's now also Anastasian text. It seems that in 1910, a certain Bill Bouquet, as the toy is called in French, just under a foot in overall length, with a handle and ball docked together, was given by Duchamp to an artist friend, Max Bergman, as a souvenir of a shared night of erotic adventure in Paris. Naumann suggests that the toy ball cum handle with naughty little impaling prong, the ball inscribed with the word Bill Bouquet, a dedication to Duchamp's friend Bergman, and the year, derives from Jarry, who not only, quote, referred to, end quote, a Bill Bouquet, quote, in one of his novellas, but in whose 1901 almanac illustré, in the illustrations of which, amazingly enough, Pierre Bonnard collaborated, quote, "The character Père Ubu is rendered vigorously playing with a Bill Bouquet positioned between his legs, a possible allusion to masturbation. Not so far-fetched, considering that one of the only rules of the game of Bill Bouquet is that it be played by a single player," end quote. The vignette in question is captioned La Jubilation de Père Ubu. By one of Jarry's novellas, Naumann must, or might as well, mean Days and Nights, which we have seen Anastasie quoting. There the character Sangle rereads the story of Sisyphus in a mirror with wings like an altarpiece. Yet by a funny loop, the matter reverts to the later, much more visually conspicuous device that Duchamp had rejected, but that seems to reappear in Anastasie's illumination. For Jarry's Mr. Sisyphus, whose burdensome rock has been sufficiently worn by wear to suggest a smooth sphere, alludes to the children's toy, Bill Bouquet, or cup and ball. Quote, "The Lord of Hosts would install all along his porphyry mountain a scenic railway wagon made from the carcass of an enormous, ready eviscerated what? A huge wasp. Une guêpe énorme, desséchée." Jarry certainly sounds Duchampian when he proceeds to write, "The Eternal, if Mr. Sisyphus had not potted his ball, placé enfant sa boule, would have created perpetual motion, which is no small matter. Since then he has sought other inventions so as to fabricate a machine involving a man that will last a long time, or at least a century. He's made many attempts, yet has come up with nothing presentable to date. That is why he starts over again the whole time, the only real Sisyphus." That's the Jarry novella. In reviewing these interrelations, it does seem that the most efficient hypothesis would be an Anastasian one, of Jarry as source for the Bill Bouquet idea, in Duchamp as well as in Anastasie himself. So I can only wonder, when Bill, reading Jarry, drew the device that recalls Duchamp's rejected so-called wasp motif, as well, perhaps, as the now unseated original ready-made, Was he thinking of Jarry's own wasp motif, or of Duchamp's, or of neither, or both? Should we ask him? I want, however, to turn at a different angle from the funnel-like form of the wasp to the earlier work of Joyce. Bill Anastasi's larger project has done much to open up an awareness of the Jarry-esque and Duchampian in Finnegan's Wake. But on a modest scale, I would like to offer a few observations and speculations in respect to A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and Ulysses. There is a certain linguistic interest in the fact that apart from the coffee filter-like sieves, which of course did make it into the bottom male half of the large glass, the so-called wasp takes the distinct form of a funnel. It seems easy enough to say that the word funnel came into Middle English from medieval Latin through Old Provençal, unless, with Joyce, we reckon the Anglo-Norman British effacement of Celtic forms. In a remarkable dialogue in the fifth and last chapter of A Portrait of the Artist, an undergraduate Stephen finds himself at loggerheads with his English Jesuit dean, or should we say Jesuit but English dean, because the governing theme is the, so to speak, black man's burden of having to put twice as much work into being good at somebody else's game. Today, one may think of the conflicted sense of inferiority, superiority of the schoolmaster trying to teach Latin to Irish-speaking children, even as British forces execute the task of Englishing Irish place names in Brian Friel's play Translations of 1980. At this point, Stephen, whose competition paper in All Too Art for Art's Sake Aesthetics he will not be permitted to present, is challenging the dean's views, but not getting anywhere. Discussion turns from the metaphorical light of Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas to the literal oil lamp by which Epictetus, the first century Stoic, wrote. To return to the lamp, he said, the feeding of it is also a nice problem. You must choose the pure oil, and you must be careful when you pour it not to overflow it, not to pour in more than the funnel can hold. What funnel? Asked Stephen. The funnel through which you pour your oil into your lamp. That, said Stephen, is called a funnel. Is it not a tundish? What is a tundish? That, the funnel. Is that called a tundish in Ireland, asked the dean? I never heard the word in my life. It is called a tundish in Lower Drumcondra, said Stephen, laughing, where they speak the best English. A tundish, said the dean reflectively, that is a most interesting word. I must look that word up. Upon my word, I must. His courtesy of manner rang a little false, and Stephen looked at the English convert with the same eyes as the elder brother in the parable may have turned on the prodigal. So Stephen's thoughts continue after speculating on the man's attraction to the Jesuits in particular. The dean repeated the word again, tundish. Well, now that's interesting. The question you asked me a moment ago seems to me more interesting. What is the beauty which the artist struggles to express from lumps of earth, said Stephen coldly. The little word seemed to have turned a rapier point of his sensitiveness against this courteous and vigilant foe, he thought. The language which we are speaking is his before it is mine. His language, so familiar and so foreign, will always be for me an acquired speech. I have not made or accepted its words. My voice holds them at bay. My soul frets in the shadow of his language. And to distinguish between the beautiful and the sublime, the dean added, to distinguish between moral beauty and material beauty, and to inquire into what kind of beauty is proper to each of the various arts, these are some interesting points we might take up. Stephen, disheartened suddenly by the dean's firm, dry tone, was silent. In the corresponding episode of the Stephen Hero manuscript, which produced already once processed material for the portrait about a decade earlier, or just about 100 years ago now, the word tundish does not yet arise. Ethnic nationalism is not yet articulated either. Perhaps in view of the dating of the manuscript, Dublin 1904 and then Trieste 1914, notwithstanding that Joyce had in a sense got out of the frying pan and into the fire, with Trieste being a center of resistance against Austrian imperial rule that after World War I would become Italian. In any case, in the earlier version, the aesthetic discussion more simply concerns representation in a way that implicates the impact of photography, while it could also be said to make room for the ready-made. Quote, the artist, he imagined, standing in the position of mediator between a world of his experience and the world of his dreams, end quote. And immediately following, but struck out from the text, is a somewhat redundant and pedantic, but now all the more interesting, appositive statement. Quote, a mediator, consequently gifted with twin faculties, a selective faculty and a reproductive faculty. In something like a variation on Kandinsky's notion of the artist as apex of a triangle of progressive spiritual awareness in concerning the spiritual and art, Joyce writes, this perfect coincidence of the two artistic faculties, he means selection and reproduction, this perfect coincidence of the two artistic faculties Stephen called poetry, and he imagined the domain of the artist to be cone-shaped. A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man itself was first published as a book in New York in 1916, while Duchamp lived there. By then, he had already drawn the most relevant wasp drawing in England, but the discussion of the funnel would surely have appealed to his sense of linguistic charm. Now that we know that it is relevant to William Anastasi's extensive trackings of a specter of Duchamp in Finnegan's Wake that the writer and the artist lived quite near one another for a time in Paris, I want to play a hunch that I have had about Joyce's earlier masterpiece in New York, where, of course, the ready-mades were initiated. It is well into Ulysses in the night town, soon after midnight, that in one of those italicized Joycean stage directions of sort, Bloom passes in the hallway of the bordello, a man's raincoat and rain hat hanging on an antlered rack. The rather punningly redundant phrase, since in American English at least, a rack is also a pair of antlers, calls to mind one of Duchamp's less notorious ready-mades, the Lost Hat Rack of 1917, redone in 1964 with Arturo Schwartz, which one of the surviving photographs of the lost original ready-made does show hanging in Duchamp's New York studio. Accompanied by Zoe Higgins, Bloom enters the music room, meeting, this is in the bordello in Nighttown, meeting there two other bawds named Kitty Ricketts and Florrie Talbot. After a definite whiff of New York with the mention of Coney Island, to which John Quinn, for one, had liked to take visiting intellectuals such as John Butler Yeats and Ezra Pound, in a hallucination of Elijah taking the form of a faith huckster above a rostrum draped with the American flag, which itself might suggest a Florian Stettheimer painting, the hardy American Elijah gives forth, if the second advent came to Coney Island, are we ready? Florrie Christ, Stephen Christ, Zoe Christ, Bloom Christ, Kitty Christ, Lynch Christ, it's up to you to sense that cosmic force. And rambles on, American style, to say, A.J. Christ Dowie and the Harmonial Philosophy have Arensberg's place, which was 33 West 67th Street. Much later in the same long episode, a character named Lynch points and says, the mirror up to nature, and laughs. Parentheses. Stephen and Bloom gaze in the mirror. The face of William Shakespeare, beardless, appears there, rigid in facial paralysis, crowned by the reflection of the reindeer antlered hat rack in the hall. And finally, at the very end of the book, another amusingly phallic mention of a hat rack recurs almost as a reverberating musical motif. Very well, but a couple of weeks ago, I was working on this section and was struck by illumination of the other internal sort. It is that the very illustration of the original hat rack ready-made, with its title in English but measurement in French, as now reproduced by Schwartz, not only shows the piece hanging in Duchamp's studio at 33 West 67th Street, Joyce's would-be 77 West 69th Street, but shows it at that before a large hall-type mirror, as Joyce has it. Was James Joyce stimulated by this very illustration? As I say, I don't know. The idea of a specter of Duchamp in Ulysses and not just the hat rack per se may by now be old Duchampian hat. But if it isn't, I want to say that it's Bill Anastasi's illumination from within his larger and seemingly ever more fruitful obsession with Jarry and Joyce connections that it's this that has driven me to tease it out. Well, I haven't proposed I made a mistake, and it's important to the discussion, so I'm going to pick up where I was reading from the American Elijah, saying, A.J. Krauss Dowie and the Harmonial Philosophy, have you got that? And don't the three women here in the bordello room, don't the three women here, Flory, Zoe, and Kitty, evoke in carnivalesque recapitulation the trio of art world sisters with whom, early on in New York, Duchamp was fast friends, not surprisingly, after having grown up with three female siblings himself, that is, the three Stettheimer sisters, Carrie, Florine, and the one who took a fancy to Duchamp, Henrietta, or Etty, who wrote fiction under the rather amusing pen name Henry Waste. If Joyce should actually have known Duchamp in Paris in about 1919-20, he would have arrived there from his studio apartment, which in being connected by a hallway to the Arenberg's duplex could have been a servant's room, where he lived for several years before going back to France. Now, others may have anticipated me in this, since this is not, as we say, my field. But for many years now, without opportunity to tell anybody about it but my wife, with whom I read the novel aloud when we first knew each other, it has seemed to me strongly suggestive of Duchamp that Joyce's American Elijah proceeds to say, okay, 77 West 69th Street, got me? That's it. You call me up by sun phone any old time. Boomsters, save your stamps. For here Joyce's charmingly mock New York Upper West Side address is in fact closely parodic of Marcel Duchamp's actual address at 33 West 67th. Well, I haven't proposed a theory or even entered upon an argument, so I suppose I should fade out into a responsible critical generalization. Then let it be that the more I remedially review the contribution of Bill Anastasi to art, but also perhaps to the general morale of art in his generation, the more fully I seem to comprehend not just more neo-Duchampian wisecracks, but an ultimately more meaningful Joycean way, with Jerry the intellectual cut-up behind both, of keeping up the great game of art. Yes. Jean-Michel. But not live. Around when might that be, Bill?
As I say, I would rather start. Has anyone been in my notes? It's the late 20s, late 20s, late 20s, something of that nature. And I believe that in Finnegan's Wake, there's a section that he inserted just at the time that Duchamp married the girl he thought was an heiress, dropping Mary Reynolds happened to be a friend of Joyce. In fact, she's described as in Joyce's inner circle. I believe that is why Professor Cipollone may be based on Duchamp, because the insertion was at the time that this was all over the newspaper. Duchamp made the world a lord and world figure. And there's a section that was inserted right at that time. Just at the time of this, and I think that the reason, in my view, the Duchamp character, Professor Cipollone, is so uncomplimentary, is that he was Mm-hmm. And although Joyce was not approved in the normal sense, they would never invite someone over who was a woman on. They didn't like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think Mary Reynolds is very much involved in
that. If I could ask a question, capitalizing on the meeting of all of us concerned, does anybody know about the circulation of this photograph with this caption that's got the term ready made in English and the French dimensions, and New York with a hyphen, as the Continental would do it? The only place that's done in New York is when it's used, carried over from the 19th century in an adjectival way, and that is in the name of the New York Historical Society. Otherwise, there's no hyphen.
Yeah. Are there only saying that this is from the Boston Blues?
From the
Boston.
Mm-hmm.
The Boston Blues. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of Duchamp's works that have these little titles on them. That might come from
the labeling. Would give that away. But then the original photograph of his own digs with the hat rack hanging in the hall mirror would have been considered worthy to include in the, along with a little real hat rack, or a real little hat rack. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Which is probably not too difficult to verify, but what is often said, and I doesn't believe this, is that Joyce was changing the original design of Ulysses for a long time under the influence of what he saw in the avant-garde in Zurich and so on.
Mm-hmm.